It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, all those who invited me. I couldn't believe it when I got to the building and it was called the Cartesian, which makes the geographer feel very at home. I am going to be talking about flooding. I realised as I was sitting on the train coming down from Hamburg Airport, I haven't dwelt hugely much on nature culture in the talk, but I'm hoping that's going to be self-evident. But I'm very happy to talk more about that afterwards, as I am to respond to questions afterwards. I understand there's recently been, just this afternoon, a seminar with some very brave undergraduates. Well done is all I can say. The piece in Theory, Culture and Society isn't necessarily the most accessible thing I've ever written. So I look forward to some challenging questions. Okay, let's kick off. This is actually a German woodcut, 16th century woodcut, illustrating the topic of the day. And what I want to talk about is some general principles around how do we better involve people in the research process, those people who are affected by flooding, in the actual process of producing both flood science and how we understand flooding, but also interventions that improve the situation in the places where they live. And much of what I'm going to be talking about draws on a particular case study in a part of England that those of you who follow cycle touring will be more familiar with than others, because they passed through Pickering in the Tour of Yorkshire last year, and I think they're doing it all again next month. But it's a part of Yorkshire, which I'll be talking about. But the general principles that I want to discuss are derived from the work of Isabel Stengers, and in particular her project of experimental constructivism. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Very happy to talk more if that's an area that you want to explore. Those of you who are interested in that dimension, I'd also direct your attention to, it's on YouTube now, a conversation that went on for a very long time, about 2 hours in the end, between Isabel Stengers and myself in the Nottingham Contemporary Art Gallery, around an exhibition called, not unlike your seminar series here, Nature Cultures. So, I'm going to start from the point of view of some of the things, and I'm sure you've had exactly the same sorts of media and newspaper coverage around flooding events in Germany, and one can replicate this all around the world. But probably the most uppermost in the minds of people in the UK, particularly in England, were the latest set of very severe floods in the early part of 2014. Particularly, this is just a map that was produced in one of the Sunday newspapers. So this is a sort of popular representation, if you like, of flood risk and flood-affected areas in England. And the area that gained most news coverage was down there in the southwest. Have I got a pointer? I don't think I have got a pointer. Just under the most westerly of the pink exclamation marks, an area called the Somerset Levels, which is anyway below water, below the sea line. Thinking of your marine enterprises here, but was very severely flooded. And these are the kinds of things. Why do these concern people? It's messy, it's smelly. I don't know if any of you have ever lived through flood events in your own hometowns. Messy for a long time, smelly for even longer. But the kinds of things that people start to count, and certainly that governments and the insurance industry counts, are the risks to property. How much damage is there going to be, and what's it going to cost, to put it right? So all kinds of maps are produced. This is a map of London, and the numbers of properties at risk of flooding. As you can see, they're concentrated around the River Thames. And all kinds of calculations that go on in the insurance industry, the UK being very unusual with respect to flood insurance. At least until very recently, flood insurance in the UK was automatically included in your household insurance. There was no extra fee or extra cost. That, of course, is all changing now. In the rest of Europe, it's much more common that you have to pay extra for flood insurance. This is a picture from the Somerset Levels in January 2014. Probably the most immediate thing that people experience is simply the disruption. This was, you can see a car floating by. This was the only means of getting in and out of a number of settlements and villages by barge, in this case bringing in supplies, bringing out elderly and vulnerable people to come the other way to get them to safety. Kinds of debates going on in the UK press around these localised flood events ranged from classic sorts of images. This is Barack Obama and a pinstripe suited individual, which basically means they work for banking or in the insurance sector. They represent the business community, trying to hold back the evidence from science about the effects of global warming on increasing the frequency and severity of extreme weather events like flooding. We don't want to listen, cost too much money. So that was one of the discourses going on in the public realm around the 2014 floods in the UK. And the other, much more localised, or at least in the national context, pointing out that at the very time when we've got more floods, austerity Britain had led to a huge reduction in the number of flood risk management experts being employed in various government agencies. So we're actually depriving ourselves of the expertise that we need to manage these floods. These are some of the contextual debates in the popular press. What I want to suggest is that whilst clearly flood events and other kinds of environmental risks and hazards, which disrupt lives, and as we've seen tragically in Nepal most recently, also threaten lives, as well as all those very disruptive and negative aspects of these events, they can nevertheless be thought of down the line, not in the immediacy of the event when we're all focused on trying to improve the situation, but longer term. We can see these kinds of environmental disturbances also as generative or having a generative dimension. In what sense can we think of them as generative? They're generative in the sense that those in science and technology studies, I'm thinking particularly about the work of people like Isabel Stengers, like Bruno Latour, or Anne-Marie Moll, or Jane Bennett, coming from a very different tradition in the United States, who see these events representing, as they do, an amalgam of natural and social forces that constitute environmental hazards and risks, intensifying the attention that's demanded by what is at issue. In other words, one of the generative ways that these events work is precisely to focus our attention on that amalgam. But floods are not straightforwardly natural hazards. It's not just about how much water falls out of the sky. It's about what we've done to the landscape onto which the water falls that makes it move faster or slower, that reduces the porosity of the earth onto which it falls, for example, by concreting over large parts of the world through settlements, and so on. In other words, they're generative in the sense that they focus our collective thinking and minds' attention on the nature of that amalgamation of natural and social forces at play in environmental disturbances of this kind. In that generative sense, then, one of the things that such events do is to force thought. They make the sorts of knowledge by which governments, insurance industries, and other major agencies responsible in some way for the management of flood risk, or for calculations about the financial consequences of flood risk, they make the sorts of science that informs those calculations and those investments usually hidden from view from the wider public, even from those most affected by flood events. They bring to the fore that science base. So how is it that insurance industries decide where the riskiest place is in terms of giving insurance cover? How is it that governments with limited resources decide where they're going to get most effect for investing in flood defences? So one of the things, the generative effects that these kinds of ontological disturbances can create is that they promote or provoke controversies around that hidden from view knowledge that informs the management of flood risk. They foster the conditions then in which expert environmental knowledge and reasoning is forced to slow down, is opened up to scrutiny. And those affected by the issue at hand, people living in places that get flooded, are motivated to scrutinise that expert reasoning more closely. This is an example of a protest poster we found in Pickering when we first went to work there, which is trying to encourage people to sign up to complain about why it is that government agencies responsible for managing flood risk have not invested in flood defences in this town. So these ontological disturbances then can give rise to knowledge controversies, controversies in which otherwise hidden science comes into public view and is subject to greater scrutiny. And in turn, that can, if you like, unsettle or open up the arrangements between politicians, expert scientists, and the public at large to give rise to opportunities to redistribute expertise, to draw on the expertise of people actually living with flooding, rather than those remotely involved in examining it in the realms of expert science, such that those publics sufficiently exercised by the issue at hand, in this case flooding, want to participate in better understanding it. Now that sequence of moves from ontological disturbances through the emergence of knowledge controversies and the creation of opportunities for more kinds of knowledge to be brought into the picture of how we understand and intervene in flood risk management can all be thought of as steps. They're by no means guaranteed. Often they're not as neatly sequential as that characterization suggests, but can be related to one of the key ideas for which Isabel Stengers is probably best known. And this is a quotation from a book that Bruce Braun and I produced on the back of a symposium that we brought together, where we specifically wanted to bring science and technology studies scholars together with political theorists to talk about the interface emerging precisely in these sorts of environmental hazards and risks that affect human lives, where those two realms of scholarship, we thought, needed to talk more closely together. So what Stengers suggests then in this idea of paying attention to the way in which things force thought, and which I think runs through that sequence of the three moves that I've just described. She puts it like this. If we take seriously those non-humans that are best characterised as forcing thought, what we need to think about and address is not the empty generality of humans as thinking beings, but what causes them to think and to object. Humans who affirm that their freedom lies in their refusal to break this attachment, even in the name of some common good. And it's that notion of the things that force thought, and in this case that I'm describing today, flooding forcing thought, that I want to develop through an application. We explicitly try to develop a methodology. How do you put that idea into research practice? What can you do with it in the world? And which brings me to the particular case that I'm going to look at and which has been written up in a number of different contexts now, and which is to Pickering, famous amongst other things, as I indicated, for the Tour de Yorkshire. So what was the flood controversy in Pickering when we went into the field here in 2007? Is it really that long ago? I think it is. So when we entered Pickering, there was a huge controversy going on around the management, or as many local people saw it, the non-management, the failure to manage flood risk adequately in this town. It's not that flood risk management, this is a town that floods regularly, it is at the foothills of some very beautiful, it's a national park, the Yorkshire Dales, the foothills of steeply rising upland areas that over the centuries have been deforested very largely, although there's still quite a lot of, by English standards, quite a lot of forestry up on the top of the hills. But it was deforested extensively in the 18th and 19th centuries, and indeed water encouraged to move more rapidly off the upland slopes by a series of drainage ditches called grips, locally, in order that farmers could profit from what was then a great boom in the wool industry for sheep farming. Take away the trees, put in the grips or the drainage ditches, water rushes off, you can intensify the keeping of sheep. So this is a town that floods regularly, particularly in the winter, which is a seasonal time in which floods occur, simply because that's the time when there's more rain, but which in 2007 experienced some very unseasonal floods in the middle of the summer of devastating levels. And the local environment agency, the body in the UK responsible for managing flood risk on the ground, on the back of those floods, commissioned an environmental consultancy, the Babtee Group in this case, to review all the possible options for better managing flood risk in this area. And the expert, the solution that they came up with, that was in a public document called the Babtee Report, was to build large concrete walls in the middle of the town, which would hold back the water in times of flood. Amongst many difficulties, this is an historic market town, its main industry is tourism, and the centre of town where the wall was going to go is next to England's oldest steam railway, which is a major tourist attraction. And so this was an unpopular solution with many people. But much more importantly, perhaps, it was also a solution that was never going to get built. Pickering is not a large enough town, think back to that calculation of properties at risk, whereby this was ever going to be a place that the Environment Agency nationally deemed would get over the cost-benefit analysis. Investing in this flood wall was not going to improve the flood risk mitigation for enough properties of enough value to make this their number one priority for investment. So the expert solution of flood walls was dead in the water. Sorry for that analogy, that was unintended. Because it was never going to be built for cost-benefit reasons. And this is what had given rise to the huge public controversy going on when we entered this area. Now the Babtee report, as all engineering consultants brought in to do these kinds of surveys and reviews of flood risk and the options for management in local areas in the UK, made very fleeting reference to the solutions that they came up with and the possible interventions that they reviewed and their assessment of them and ranking of them in terms of effectiveness as having been based upon the use of a mathematical computer-based model. Nothing more is said. There is no material, no appendix, no annex that tells you anything about, well, what were the assumptions in this model? Was the model a model used by other flood scientists or hydrological modellers? Was it credible? Was it a good model? Was it an indifferent model? Nothing is found out about the model. All we know is that they used a mathematical computer-based model. Not very easy for those affected by flooding and concerned about the lack of an effective management or investment in flood risk management in the town. Nothing for them to interrogate, to get into, to scrutinise in any way. You know, I gather, some of you in the audience know far more about flood risk modelling than I do. But for those for whom, I came at this new, although it was an interdisciplinary project and we worked with hydrological modellers and so on. But very crudely, that reference in the Babtie report makes reference to the primary form of expert knowledge production involved in the assessment and investment in flood risk management. Very roughly speaking, we can see a triangulation in the hydrological modelling practices between the observations of the actual system, particularly historic observations. Self-evidently, one uses models when there is no data about a future event. That's the nature. If you're trying to predict events or to forecast the likelihood of flood risk of a particular magnitude, you can't rely on direct observation. You can rely on historic data for previous flood events, and that represents the actual system. That can, the physical properties of a particular, a localized system, the slope, the width of channels, the number of streams or rivers, the type of surface that water falls onto, all those kinds of dimensions of the dynamics of flood risk can be modeled mathematically. And indeed, that's been going on since before the 19th century. The bit that is particular to second half of the 20th century onwards, modelling the third leg in the stool, if you like, of how hydrological modellers work, is that this is all now computerised. Flood modellers, by and large, across the world, use something between 5 and 6 different kinds of software programs. These are the only programs authorized by many of the government agencies responsible for investing in the science that informs flood risk management. Most of them are proprietary, that is to say you have to pay to use them. One or two are not. Consultants, by and large, are not innovators in the modelling process. They get data for the area they've been employed to model. They plug that data into the computer program that they're working with that's been derived elsewhere. They run the numbers multiple times, so-called simulations, and they see what comes out the other end. So this is the primary way in which the science or the expert knowledge that informs flood risk management comes into being. In other words, this modelling expertise is actually a constitutive dimension of flood alert processes and investment decisions. Without them, there wouldn't be any of those things. So here we are in Pickering, or the Vale of Pickering. See the dark, well, it's all quite dark actually on this particular, but the darker, the really black areas. Those are the uplands, top of the uplands, North York Moors. Vale of Pickering is a low-lying area, very rich agriculturally, with a number of market towns, including Pickering itself, in there. And you can see very roughly the movement of water down that series of slopes. So all water moves down the slopes, and just above Pickering, all the streamlets converge, and it gets the maximum volume at its door. And when we went there in 2007, we were alerted pretty much this was the main topic in all the local papers. Local anger about the lack of investment in flood management, this flood wall not being built. So that was the High Street in Pickering in the June 2007 summer floods. So what did this flood event, and it was particularly the unseasonality of this flood event, that did the forcing of thought in this particular context? And the key issue that came into scrutiny amongst people who lived in this town and were affected by this prolonged flood event was to problematise, to want to ask the question, have they defined what the problem of flood risk in our place correctly, sensibly, reasonably, or not? Because from what we can see, not being able to interrogate the science. Whatever it is that they're doing, it isn't working. So the kinds of questions that we kept hearing repeatedly when we first went into the field were, why do they keep saying it's a 1 in 100 year event when we've been flooded twice in 5 years? The calculations don't seem to be working too well. We're the ones with the experience of flooding. Why aren't the experts interested in what we know? One of the most irritating things for local people was that the agency responsible for flood risk management had simply stopped engaging with them because they kept asking difficult questions. So that's the context in which we arrived and wanted to try and conduct an experiment in public science informed by Stenger's notion of the way in which things and events like flood risk force thought, and to see whether or not we could put her notion of experimental constructivism into some kind of research practice, collaborating with local people affected by flooding in this locality. We also worked in another locality, but for the purposes of today, I'm just going to talk about Pickering. So what is Stenger's experimental constructivism? You can find out much more about it at that web link there. It's a collective project, interdisciplinary project based at the Free University in Brussels, collaborating with students, staff from different disciplines, and so on. And what the idea takes at its heart are a number of things. Of course, I'm simplifying, but I'm highlighting here three things. First of all, the idea, the project of experimental constructivism indicates, above anything else, a positive interest in what makes a particular construction in all its dimensions take hold. Why was the flood wall the expert solution produced by an environmental consultancy, the Babti Group? Why did that particular construction of the nature of the problem of flood risk and how it was best ameliorated take hold in Pickering? Nothing else ever got discussed. That was it. Once produced by the consultants, this was like a magnet. Anything to do with flood risk management got drawn to the Babti Group's flood wall. What is it that makes a particular construction take hold? The second interest of the project of experimental constructivism is, as the name would suggest, in an experimental ethos. That is, an ethos, a way of working, that stresses the conditions and possibilities of subjecting scientific practices and propositions to various forms of public trial, actually putting expert reasoning and knowledge to the test beyond the usual laboratories and screens, in the case of hydrological modelling, to public trial in those places where publics are affected by the kinds of problems being modelled. And this in turn then demands the invention, as she puts it, of apparatuses that enable those most affected by expert reasoning to participate in the construction and indeed the reconstruction of the problem that affects them, in our case, flood risk. And this is where this experimental methodology that we try to devise and develop, put to the test in Pickering, comes in. We were trying, in essence, to invent an apparatus to follow through this injunction on her part. And in theory, we came up with a rather ugly name for this experimental methodology of competency groups. I can tell you why we stuck with this rather ugly name. We derived it from a paper that Stengers has written elsewhere. I can say more about that if you're interested. So what in theory did we try to do? What did we set out to try to do? We set out to try and devise a methodology, a collaborative methodology, of investigating flood risk, producing knowledge about flood risk, and proposals for alternative interventions that involved social and natural scientists, on the one hand, in the project team, and those scientists collectively working with flood-affected communities, working together to interrogate and redistribute the expertise that governed the construction of flood risk management in the localities in which we worked. We could specify ahead of time that we thought that to do this effectively would require a commitment from all the participants to respect the very different kinds of knowledge and modes of reasoning that each member of a competency group brings to the table, to the collaboration. And thirdly, we had figured out ahead of time that the usual sorts of ethics protocols, I'm sure your institution is as obsessed as ours is with completing your ethics compliance forms before you're allowed to go and do any field research, and that those standard ethics compliance practices derive from a kind of medical sciences model of the world. That is to say, you, researcher, want to extract something from some innocent party, the research subject, bring it back home and do something with it subsequently. And therefore your ethics compliance procedures require that innocent research subject to agree that you can do whatever you like with whatever it is that they extract. That's not going to work in a collaborative competency group setting where the whole idea is that be you one of the social or natural scientists or be you one of the members of the local community affected by flooding, you all have absolutely equal claim on any knowledge that the collective group produces together. So we had to devise our own ethics protocol for everybody to sign. And interestingly, but another story, it was some of the scientists who were most wary of allowing local members of the group to use some of the knowledge we produced together for their own purposes. But we got over that hurdle. So that's the theory. So the whole point about competency groups in designing a method is not to design the outcome. No idea where this collaboration is going to lead, whether it's going to lead anywhere. It's about the process. It's about creating an atmosphere, collaborative opportunity to produce new knowledge about flooding in this place and potentially come up with new suggestions or propositions for how to intervene and ameliorate the situation. That's the theory. This is the practice. This was what it looked like. We met in the building on the right, and it was flooded when we held our first competency group meeting. This is a picture taken on the bridge. There were sandbags all around. The building on the right is the Civic Centre. We were on the lower portion of that, spending quite a lot of our time looking out to see if the water was rising any further. But this is the practice, being in the place where it happens. And in the very first meeting that we held, so we worked together as a group over, in this case, a 15-month period, with bi-monthly meetings, all kinds of activities going on in between, field visits, video recording, all kinds of measurements and other things. But in the very first meeting, I think we gained a strong sense of some of the issues locally. The trouble with experts. This is MP, one of the local members of the group. Every time we get the floods, we get the meeting with the EA, the Environment Agency. And they come along and somebody sits at the front and, oh, we won't do any dredging because this, that, and the other. You've got to hear a Yorkshire disparaging accent at this point. I can't do Yorkshire. And you sit there as a layman, and you probably noticed I tend to ask a lot of questions. I never have the answers. And I think to myself, why doesn't dredging affect it? Because just thinking about it from a simple plumbing point of view, and he then goes into an analogy with drain pipes, it doesn't tie in with what these people say. And yet as a non-scientist, as a layman, I just sit there and think, this is an expert. How do you argue with that? And indeed, in our group, where some of the members of the group from the university membership were hydrological modellers, were the experts, we had to spend quite a lot of effort and time trying to find a way of working together. One of the first things we came up against was a complete clash of vocabularies. So I'll just take one of these examples, and it's MP's gutter analogy. So we started by trying to find a way of communicating. You think about a gutter, says MP, how much can go through it? And if it fills up, it comes over the top. So if you've got half the size of gutter, he's talking about leaves accumulating and all kinds of detritus getting in your gutter, reducing the width and the depth of it. So if you've got half the size of a gutter, it comes over the top more quickly. Well, to hydrological modellers, the principle of volume conservation for an incompressible fluid represents the same thing. And we could go on. Our solution that we developed in trying to work together was to put much more onus, or as much onus, not on vocabulary, not on the things that we could say to one another, but on working with things, trying things out together as a means of learning, actually thinking with the materials that make us think, that prompt thought. This is a picture of possibly the first or second competency group. So we're now inside that building that you saw with the flooding outside. It looks like a tea break. And in essence, what we did was, as a group, as a whole, to put diverse knowledge claims to the test. Knowledge claims produced by experts. So how did they come up? What was the science that informed the idea of a flood wall on which the town had become completely fixated? Ideas that local members of the group who had actually experienced flooding here came up with as what might make a difference. And we put those diverse knowledge claims to the test by working them through various intermediaries. If language was going to be a little bit of a tricky bit, what kinds of materials could we work that through? Maps, computer models themselves, photo and video images, instrumentation out in the landscape like rain gauges, and so on, all became part of our working practice. I'm just going to take you through a few of them. So we begin with the expert map of the 2007 summer flood event. But the map's wrong is about the first thing that people who live in this place, who joined the group, had to say to us. And we took several meetings to get people comfortable with the idea that they could interrogate the experts, that they could say, well, they say it flooded there. Well, it didn't. They say it didn't flood over there, and it did. We were there. We saw what was happening. We started to correct the official flood map. We started to get all kinds of first-hand observation of sequences, timings, where floods first. If here floods, you can guarantee that over there is going to flood because of the connection between those two points. The beginnings, if you like, of confidence in articulating local observation and experiential knowledge. We tried out all the pet theories that local members of the group brought with them, most notably dredging, which was the most popular idea locally as to what would completely get rid of the flood problem in Pickering. Drain the whole of the river, dredge it right down from the bottom of the escarpment from the moors down to the sea, scrape about 3 foot out, problem gone. No, nothing will be left. Nobody will be harmed. What a fantastic idea. It's only the wildlife that's going to hold us back. Why are we prioritising wildlife over local people and their properties? So we tried out dredging. By this time, we were using just a graphic user interface to try and get people to be able to picture this catchment. And we tried out the expert view. We tried out everybody's pet theories, including dredging. And although it looks a bit like a Sarah Palin viewfinder for targeting something, we were using, enabling people to try out, okay, what if we put intervention X or Y in this location or that location? How does that alter the way in which the water moves across this landscape, and hence the propensity for this town to flood? And we included in our trials there dredging. And one of the most important things that we all learned through this process, as well as simulating different kinds of interventions and what sorts of impacts they might have on the hydrological landscape, we got to understand, and indeed, dredging did have a marginal effect. However, what we learned alongside that is that dredging did indeed make it better for the particular house of the person most in favour of dredging before the group met. Unfortunately, it displaced the worst of those effects on people currently unaffected by flooding further down in the town. And seeing those displacement effects was as educational for all of us as seeing the results of trying out our own ideas through this graphic interface. So dredging, kind of yes, but equally no. Until one of the local members of the group came up with what retrospectively we all saw as a game changer. Don't we need to stop the water higher up? Was their question. Why are we all fixated on looking at intervening in the town? Wouldn't it be sensible to do something up there where the water comes from? And so we turned our attention to upstream, so-called upstream storage solutions. So if all this stuff was rushing off these uplands, these deforested slopes, part of the problem of flooding in Pickering was their convergence with nothing blocking them at just outside Pickering, and hence the propensity of Pickering to flood. Having come up with this idea and explored it through the same graphic user interface models of this locality, using local information as well as remotely sensed information, the group felt confident enough to go public. One of the conditions that local members of the group had made when they joined up was that we weren't just going to have a nice, however informative, series of discussions between the university members of the group and local members of the group. They actually wanted to make an intervention in the public debate locally. That was their price for working with us for 12 months, or as it turned out, 15. To go public, we had to invent a name for ourselves. Competency group really doesn't do well in the public domain. It's a rather academic sort of term. So we decided we'd call ourselves the Rydale Flood Research Group, Rydale being the river valley, the principal river valley in which Pickering sits. Having done any number of simulations in which upstream storage looked as if, for quite modest costs, it had at least as great a potential impact on ameliorating flood risk as had the expert proposal of a flood wall, we started to put together a public exhibition to take this proposition into the public realm. And we held a public exhibition in that same civic centre, indeed in the rooms in which we had been meeting over this series of months as a group, in October 2008, a little over a year since we had started working together. And in that exhibition, we wanted to publicise this upland storage proposition. But we also wanted to publicise the working methods that had enabled us as a group of collaborators between university members and local members of the group to work together and produce this proposition. What had been our working methods? How had we produced the knowledge claims that led to that proposition? And also to enable people who came to the exhibition to try out the graphic user interface for themselves, to try out some of their own ideas. The exhibition attracted a very large number of people. The members of the Environment Agency locally and others also came. They kept quite a low profile, they weren't very popular in the public domain at that point. We had a sequence of posters that tried to explain our working methods. We had a series of screens that people could try out the flood model, the upstream storage model for themselves. You could plug in your own address, see what difference this made to the movement of water and how it might affect you. And there were a number of other forms of flood modelling taking place, most notably a physical form of flood modelling produced to entertain children, though, as you can see in this picture here, it seemed to entertain the adults rather more than the children. So this was using old bottles and small paddling rings to demonstrate the same principles of the hydrological movement of water and some of the principles that we'd been looking at in our studies. We got a lot of press coverage, television, radio, and local newspapers. And the proposition that the Rydell Flood Research Group put into the public domain of upstream storage being a potentially useful intervention started to gain traction. The Gazette and Herald is one of the local papers. Another, which, as you know, when you put anything into the public domain, you lose all control over the words used. So having worked very hard for 15 months not to have ourselves thought of as boffins, the Moulton and Pickering Mercury rapidly reverted to caricature, and they wrote that a team of top university boffins and local residents have come up with new solutions to the flooding in Pickering. They suggested a series of buns, or mini dams, be built on the moors north of the town to hold back water at times of flood. But what was interesting to all of us was that there was quite as much media interest, not just in this potential intervention that might ameliorate flooding in the locality, but in the very curious notion that boffins might work with local residents. This was also got just as much attention. So if it started to travel, it's still travelling now. It started to affect the way in which various of the flood risk management agencies in the UK invest in flood risk. Our proposition has now been put to the official test in what's called a demonstration project from the Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. And this whole approach to flood risk management has now been renamed as the whole catchment approach, or worse from our point of view, natural flood risk management, which is ironic. So what's left behind? What can we say about this project and this attempt, if you like, to put some of Stenger's ideas into research practice? Bruno Latour redirects our attention in trying to evaluate research events from some of the usual questions, perhaps, in the social sciences that we ask ourselves. The question he suggests that we have to ask ourselves is not whether we have accurately represented some pre-existing phenomena or entity, but whether there is a distance between the contents of the world before and after the inquiry. A repertoire of actions now and the repertoire with which we started. So I want to make two observations about this particular experimental project. First of all, I think we can say a little about the way in which the competency group methodology has itself travelled. We're currently in the process of producing a web-based toolkit such that other communities can apply it and put it to use in relation to other local knowledge controversies, whether about flood management or other kinds of environmental risk. The name of the game in the UK at the moment, for those of you familiar with research assessment exercises, is impact. And so in packaging this up, we hope to magnify that impact, the impact that we had in Pickering. We've also just begun a large project in the Thames catchment in the south of England on drought, where an element of that project will also involve the use of competency groups with communities affected by drought. But much more importantly than the way in which the methodology has travelled within academic and public circles is that the upland storage solution has now received funding and has been built. On the left, you can see the woody debris dams, which was one part of the proposition. Many of these, quite small scale, look a bit like beaver dams in the upland parts of the catchment. And the final element, not yet complete, is a large earth bund immediately outside the town, which, when it's fully completed, will be landscaped into the landscape. I'll close by the dilemma that we now face, which is that, of course, a very, very small part of us now needs a flood to test whether these interventions have made a difference, but it is only a very, very small part of us. Thank you.